From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1896, Utah was a brand new state, and right out of the chute, the state's Democratic Party asks Martha Hughes Cannon to run for state senator. It's a big deal because she was a woman at a time when this was thought of as a man's job, but unlike most of the rest of the country, women in Utah could vote. They could run for office. And here's the thing, the state's Republican Party picked her husband to run for the office. So she's running against her husband, a guy, we should say, who has five other wives, and she wins. The newspaper, the Salt Lake Herald, endorsed her, called her the better man. It's just one story of a remarkable life. Martha Hughes Cannon was a physician, an advocate for women's rights, but also a true believer, a polygamist wife. Today in the program, we're profiling a new documentary about her, and we hope you'll join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are exploring the life of a remarkable Utah woman, Martha Hughes Cannon. In an era when women were struggling for some basic rights, Cannon became a physician. She was a scholar, an advocate, a politician. 1896, the year of the statehood, she became the first woman to serve as a state senator. She was the first one in the country, in fact. But she also happened to be a polygamist wife. Public television station KUED has produced a documentary about Martha Hughes Cannon, and today in the program, we're using it as a way to talk about her life. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Nancy Green is with us here in the studio, the producer of the documentary. It's called Martha Hughes Cannon. Among her other films are Utah, The Struggle for Statehood, and Maynard Dixon, To the Desert Again. Nancy, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Constance Lieber is with us. She's co-editor of the book Letters from Exile. It's a collection of correspondence between Martha Hughes Cannon and her husband, Angus M. Cannon. Lieber was a manuscript cataloger at the LDS Church Historical Department, and she's currently writing a biography of Martha Hughes Cannon. So, Constance Lieber, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Michael Quinn is with us. D. Michael Quinn, an independent historian whose work focuses on the LDS Church. He's got a lot of books. So they include Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview and the Mormon Hierarchy series. And Michael Quinn, welcome back to you. Thanks for being
with
us. The film, we should mention, we'll give you more details about this as we go along, but it premieres Sunday on KUED. So, Nancy, I want to start with you. So when did you first... You always known who she was, sort of? Or when did you first hear about Martha Hughes Cannon?
Actually, it was years ago when Ken Verdoya and I worked on Utah, The Struggle for Statehood.
Yeah.
And I just remember reading about this remarkable woman. And but it seemed as if I only knew a few facts about her. I really didn't know much about her as a human being.
Right.
So she was just this character for me. And then Ken actually came into my office one day and said, why don't we revisit history like we used to?
Yeah.
And I thought, okay. And I thought, I don't want to do another story about another guy. Right. I mean, I just really, I was like, they're wonderful male characters in Utah history, but enough.
Yeah.
And so I thought, what woman could I do? And I thought about Martha Hughes Cannon right away. Her name just popped into my head.
Yeah.
And I looked her up. And as I got to know her more and more, her story, she's fascinating. She's complex. And I just realized what a rich story she would be.
Yeah. In the film, you identify what seems to be a really important theme in her life, which is this clash that's going on. There's this clash, which we'll work through it throughout the show today, because I think there are a lot of really interesting stories in here, but that there's a clash between romance and faith. Mm-hmm. There's this clash between ambition and tradition. It seems like that was one of the things, I guess, that kind of defined who she was in some ways.
And she really was this bit of a paradox. I mean, she really was somebody who is an incredible romantic, an incredibly passionate person, a dramatic person on one hand.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she was also somebody who embraced her faith and entered, made decisions along that line that were in conflict with her passions. And so, you know, just imagine you're this romantic, you have this romantic view of the world, and yet you enter into a polygamous marriage. How do you reconcile those?
Yeah.
She was incredibly ambitious, and yet she also wanted what many women want, right? A soulmate, a relationship. So she wanted to do good in this world and pursue amazing things, and yet she also had to deal with the realities of her life.
Constance Lieber, what makes her When did you first start paying attention to her? Now, as I understand it, you were a cataloger in the history department at the LDS Church. And you sort of come across some letters. Is that your kind of introduction in
some way?
Well,
at the time, there were a lot of collections that had just been given temporary numbers and stuck back in the archives. And I was taking them out one by one to catalog them.
Yeah.
And I pulled out this one, been given the name Martha Munn Letters. And I read two or three of them. It was very clear that this was no one named Martha Munn. Hmm. I didn't know a whole lot about church history at the time, so I went to my supervisor, Jeff Johnson, and he looked at it. It took us about 2 minutes to figure out this was letters written by Martha Hughes Cannon to her husband and that she was in exile in England. That caught my fancy, and my interest has grown from there.
What was so interesting for you about her, do you think?
Well, first of all, the idea of being in exile. I did not know much about Mormon history at all, and I had no idea of this aspect of its history. And so the thought to me of someone being so far away and then writing letters home, but at the same time, her letters gave a lot of information about her days at university and her friends and her former boyfriends and her struggles as a young mother. And she was so lively, so engaged with life. At least in the early letters.
What, and things turn, which we'll talk about. And she seems completely not entirely excited about being so far away from home. But what's the personality that emerges in those letters? You said engaging and lively. Do you think she would have been funny? Happy? Do you think she laughed? Do you get any sense of that in the letters?
Well, she certainly had a sense of humor. A couple of her letters are... It's sort of restrained, sort of below the radar sort of humor. She was in the country for a time outside of Stratford-upon-Avon with another polygamous wife in exile. And at one point they had to leave because people were getting upset, kind of thinking who they knew she was. And she wrote a letter to Angus, which I love. And she just introduces it. She says, but why leave our country retreat? And she goes on to say, latterly the name of Mormon has been associated with us. And those who think they know what it means have been eager to inform those who don't. And she talks about the threshers in the field telling them to let them dust out her skirt because she doesn't have a husband and so on. And it's really amusing and lively.
I want to ask about her family sort of make, Nancy, they make this trek to the Salt Lake Valley. I mean, she comes over when she's born in Wales, and they come over. Parents become Mormon converts, and they make their way here when she's really young. And her family eventually make the trek to the Salt Lake Valley, like other saints. They get here 1861, I think it is. Her sister dies along the way. Her father dies two or three days after they get here. And I guess in some ways, this is the thing. I want to play a clip, in fact, from the film. This is Blaine Brady. He's an historian. He's talking about the fact that that experience seemed to be something that defined what she wanted from her life. Let me play this. Here's a moment from the film Martha Hughes Cannon.
I think she swore to herself that she would do something about this, that the suffering wouldn't be in vain, that, you know, there must be a way of preventing some of these things that happen. It certainly profoundly affected how she lived the rest of her life.
So these deaths that she sees and the whole experience itself, it makes her want to what? To heal.
To heal. And Blaine is actually, he's the family historian. He's her great-great-grandson.
Huh.
And according to the family lore, this was a pivotal point for her. But she, you know, she was only four. But you have to also realize, growing up, she would have seen a lot of death, a lot of suffering.
Yeah.
You know, in the 1860s in the Utah Territory, it was just commonplace to witness this. And she really was somebody who not only wanted to do something, she had the drive to do something.
Yeah.
So I think it was a huge influence on her.
Michael Quinn, I want to involve you into this conversation at this point because so I'm wondering, first of all, there's this idea of it's pretty unusual, I guess, for a young woman to say at that time that she wants to be a medical doctor. But the thing I think that makes the story so intriguing is that the Utah Territory was not typical of American culture in the way women were regarded. Nancy, as you say in the film, this is the study in contrasts. And Michael Quinn, I wanted to get you on that because women were thought of in sort of different ways in this culture.
In Utah culture, women had rights legally that virtually no women in the United States had at the time. Very early, almost from the arrival of the Mormons in Utah, there were practical freedoms that they had, and then those became enshrined in law. Women could own property independently. They were not the femme sole. They were not the property of their fathers, then to be transferred to their husbands. They were independent. They could own property. They could divorce. In Utah, had the most liberal divorce laws in the nation, and it allowed women to divorce simply on the basis of incompatibility. And that was under civil law, and under Brigham Young's rule as president of the church, he was the one who granted divorces to polygamous wives. And all a woman needed to do was just say she was unhappy, and he would give her a divorce. If a man requested a divorce, he had hell to pay, because Brigham would not simply give him a divorce because he requested it. And he always required the man to pay for the divorce, whether it was requested by the woman or not. And women had access to the ballot. Wyoming gave women legally the right to vote, but Utah snuck in and allowed them to vote before Wyoming did. And so they had this competition for who was going to give women the vote first. And in practical terms, women voted first in Utah. So they were not only given this legal right in terms of the law, but Brigham Young, long before that, had encouraged women to enter professions that typically had been limited to men, including the law and medicine. And he told men that, you know, if you don't have the skills to handle the bookkeeping in your ranches, give your wives the ability because they're typically better at this than men are. And so he frequently encouraged, even though we see him from our perspective as being very patriarchal and autocratic, he nonetheless had a very broad understanding and perspective of what women's rights should be, both legally and practically in the home.
But why? Was it because was the polygamist element the thing that informed that in some way?
Polygamy had an ad hoc, unintended consequence, I think, that because men frequently had their wives in different towns or different parts of a city, and under the pressures of the federal government, even sometimes different counties, different states, men were occasional visitors in the households of their wives, whether they were the legal wife or the plural wives. And as a result, women had de facto independence. They had to run their households. And if they had a farm, they had to take care of all of the farm and the farm hands and all of the practical things, because the husband was around perhaps once every few weeks, perhaps every few months. So there was this de facto independence that came into plural families. But also there was the Joseph Smith example, where he established one of the earliest women's organizations that had been established by a church. And it was initially established for charitable purposes, but it gave women the opportunity to exercise administrative rights independently. And his wife was the president of that organization in 1842. And so Brigham Young had that example and he frequently said he was an apostle of Joseph Smith and wanted to carry out everything that Joseph Smith either had done or hoped for. And so these expanded opportunities for women were a part of that for Brigham Young.
I want to play another clip from the film. Nancy, this is something spoken by Martha Hughes Cannon here. Because I want to ask the question of, you know, on some levels she seemed rebellious.
Mm-hmm.
But on some levels, again, here's that tension coming up, but on some levels she seemed like absolutely not. I am of the faith. I am not. I'm with it. And so the question of where she sort of thought of herself in terms of being a woman in the scheme of things is really interesting. Here's another moment. This is a do you want to say the name of the actor playing Martha Hughes Kennett?
Sure,
offhand?
It's Sandra Shotwell.
Sandra Shotwell, of course. Okay. Reading the role of Martha Hughes Cannon.
I know that women who stay at home all the time have the most unpleasant homes there are. You give me a woman who thinks about something besides cook stoves and wash tubs and baby flannels, and I'll show you 9 times out of 10 a successful mother.
So was that outrageous for its time?
I think it was pretty progressive for its time. She was somebody who, I think, first of all, she hated housework, but and who could blame her? But she was a mix, and I think the women of the time were an interesting mix, where she viewed herself as having a rebellious spirit, as somebody who wanted to push for rights for women, for all people. And yet, on the other hand, you know, she would say, "Well, you know, I never want to be a man. I don't want to be manly. You know, I love being a woman." Yeah. And she would, you know, say, "I want to run for office, but there are certain offices you shouldn't run for, like governor. That's too manly." Mm. So there is this interesting line between, you know, where do we push? Where do we push for more rights? Where do we push for equal representation? Where do we push for having careers and minds of our own? And yet also being a product of Victorian America.
Yeah. Well, so, but she's also constantly, but she is a true believer. I mean, she is. Do you ever get a sense that she has, and we'll talk about this as her sort of relationship and her life goes on, but does she ever express much in the way of doubt about that?
Well, in the letters she wrote, it's not so much doubt that she expresses as the difficulty of doing what she believes. She says things like, if it weren't for basically for my faith in God, I would have given this whole plural system a wide berth. But she never says, I don't believe in it. Mm-hmm. It's very clear from her letters that she knows for herself that this is the right thing to do, and she's more than willing to do it.
She also says some interesting, she says at one point in a letter that maybe this would have been easier if I was a first wife.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah. 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 Well, we'll get into that, because I think just making the decision itself seems extraordinary, especially where the course of her life seems to be going at that time. But one thing I wanted to make note of, and something that kind of made me sick, and it's the image of these journals being burned.
Mm-hmm.
How long after she had died?
It's hard to know.
It's hard to know. But they were burned.
But they were burned.
Why?
Often in her letters, she actually writes these letters to Angus, her husband.
Yeah.
And often she says, please burn this letter after you receive it. And I think it was because here is a time when women weren't supposed to necessarily complain. Women weren't supposed to give voice to the difficulties that they were going through.
Yeah.
And she let it loose in her letters. Mm. I mean, she did not censor herself. And I think she didn't want to be perceived as somebody who was going through such difficult times. And she wanted, in a way, to keep her passions under wraps,
yeah.
I think. And so it in a way, it does make sense. You know, if these are her letters that are so passionate and revealing, if she went
What's in the
journal? It makes me wonder, because I don't know about you, but when I write in my journal, it's not always the happiest moments of my life.
Michael Quinn, is that typical to have burned a journal like that? I mean, how extraordinary is that? And what do you think?
Burn this letter. I think the first example I think of is Joseph Smith writing to the father and mother of his recently married bride, Sarah Ann Whitney, and she's an etc. in the greeting of the letter to Newell K. Whitney and wife, etc. And in the letter, he talks about arranging a rendezvous and gives all the instructions for doing it, including be careful of Emma and make sure that you don't let her know what you're going to be doing. And then he gives this instruction, burn the letter.
Yeah.
And luckily, for understanding another side of his personality, the Whitney family chose not to burn that letter. But I think because of the, particularly the legal issues and jeopardy involved with plural marriage, many documents were burned, not for censorship by historians or by family members, but by the people who received them. And for the journal writers, That also, I mean, and on reflection, that became a pattern. For example, Reed Smoot's diaries. During the time when he was a freshman senator and was being investigated by the U.S. Senate and all of the anguish that he experienced personally, those diaries are missing. Mm-hmm. And it could be that he destroyed them. It could be also that he donated them to the First Presidency's office, and they are currently in his vault, in its vault. That I don't know. But it would have been consistent for him to read through those and see all of the candid things he wrote during that investigation and to decide, I don't want anyone, even my family, reading this. And he could have burned them.
Yeah. Gosh, but it makes you wonder, why would you write a journal if in the end you said, all right, burn it?
It's a good question. I mean, I think she needed an outlet. I mean, here's a woman who
that's interesting. She's venting.
I'm guessing, right? Because
who knows?
Right?
Course,
this is all theoretical. Yeah. But she's this really interesting contrast between a very dramatic side of herself and also a more stoic kind of
get on with it
side of herself. And I had trouble reconciling that a little bit when I was reading her letters and hearing stories from the family. And then I came across this one letter that talked about her facade and how people thought she was so together and that she was maybe a little cold. But underneath it all, she had all of this passion and she really was nervous. And so I wonder if really, you know, it was in a way maybe a form of just venting for her.
Yeah.
But did the burning occur after her death?
Yeah.
It did.
Oh, well, then that's a whole different dynamic. Then it could have been censorship by the children.
Right.
Well, apparently she had made her son promise before she died that he would do that.
Oh,
I think along with all the other things, certainly with the letters, it was worried that they would be intercepted by federal marshals giving more ammunition to convict Angus of polygamy. But I think she definitely wanted, in a way, to direct her own legacy. And she can't do that if these diaries exist where she wrote who knows what. She may not have known herself anymore.
Here's another moment from the film of Martha Hughes Cannon.
For people have said I had a strong nerve when in reality I was nervous, that I had no feeling when my pent-up feeling like a canker worm was gnawing me internally, that the storms of life affected me none, and that the softer emotions of the human heart were unknown to me.
From Nancy Green's documentary, Martha Hughes Cannon, we should mention that Sunday night at 8 o'clock, KUED is premiering the film. For details, you can go to our website, KUER.org/Radio West. Nancy Green is with us along with Constance Lieber, and we have D. Michael Quinn with us as well. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a new documentary film produced by the public television station KUED. Nancy Green is the producer, and she's joining us here, along with Constance Lieber, co-editor of the book Letters from Exile, The Correspondence of Martha Hughes Cannon and Angus M. Cannon. And the historian D. Michael Quinn is with us as well. The film, by the way, is premiering on Sunday night. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. So I want to ask about it's interesting. She goes to, she decides to be, to go to medical school. And I guess this question came up to me. Was she a feminist? Like, is that a proper term to describe Martha Hughes Cannon?
I think the term feminist wasn't even around.
No, and of course it wasn't. But would you use that term now? Because she cuts her hair, for example. That's so interesting. She cuts her hair because I just want it to be more convenient.
Yeah, she's practical.
She goes to medical school, but she decides not to go to one of the women's medical schools. She goes, she wants to dig in there with the men.
Mm-hmm. I think she, you know, if you define a feminist as somebody who's pushing for equality, you know, an equal treatment, she definitely was. Right. So I think it all depends on how you define that term. But yeah, she didn't see herself, I think, as overthrowing the patriarchy.
No.
But I think she did see herself as pushing for equal rights for all women and for all people.
Yeah.
I think that has to be qualified a little bit. Certainly she was doing that, but she was living in the Victorian era. And when she talks so much about women and, you know, not worrying about the baby flowers, talking about other things, she means women of her class. She does not mean the women she hires to do her ironing.
Oh, that's you know, amazing.
So there's still a classism
going
on.
Yeah. Well, she had other interests, Constance Lieber. I mean, she that went beyond medicine. In the film, you talk about how she was naturally dramatic. Was really into public speaking, I guess.
Well, she attended, when she was in Pennsylvania doing an additional year of medical school, she attended the National School of Oratory and Elocution. I think that's it. Mm-hmm. And there she was able to let her dramatic side out. And she's written up in the newspapers as being excellent, you know, a great tragedian, they said. Hmm. She could have been on the stage. But she wanted to go not to prepare for a role as an actress, but for public speaking on public health issues. And that is a dialogue through her whole life, that next month I will have time to do that. But this month my head is too bad, and I will have time, and I will have time. She never did, except on a few scattered occasions, and it's really rather sad. Blaine told me when she died, she had a library of over 200 books.
Wow.
None of them read.
Wow. Hmm. I think this is interesting, too. So she returns home after that schooling. You know, she's kind of had this amazing experience in the world outside of Mormonism, and she comes back. She's 25. And I guess the question was, was she seen as an oddity? I mean, she wasn't married, and she was 25, which must have been approaching old maid status, at least in that era, right?
I think so. I mean, she was the only woman who went to medical school without being married during that period. So I think she was, on one hand, considered I think she was always a bit of an outsider in some way in the LDS circles, especially circles with women. She writes about having difficulty having relationships with women, close friends. She has a few, but they're from outside of Utah. So I think she is, unlike an amazing woman like Emmeline B. Wells, who is a Utah suffragist and newspaper editor, who is very much on the inner circle. Even when she was trying to be in that inner circle, she was always on the outside.
Martha was. Always on the outside.
Always on the outside.
Somehow she tended to alienate people. And it's a little bit of curiosity why. I think her personality was very forceful.
Yeah.
She did not shy away from stating her opinion. And she wasn't always welcome where she went.
Yeah.
Now, you spend some time with this kind of next big step. Here's what seems to be a fairly, at this point, worldly woman now, practicing physician. And she chooses to marry into a polygamist relationship. That is wild.
And not just a polygamist relationship. She chooses a man 23
years old. 23 years old.
23 years older than herself.
Than herself, of course. Sorry, yes.
Okay, with far older than
herself.
With 17 kids.
Yep.
Three other wives. And she wasn't a woman who didn't have choices. I mean, she had a suitor come back, follow her back to Utah because he wanted to marry her from out east. But she makes this life step. And I think looking at it from our perspective, you just have to scratch your head and go, what were you thinking?
Yeah. But what was she thinking?
I think, you know, the person who really explained this to me is sitting right next
to
me.
Yeah, no, Michael,
what
was she thinking? Because this is really, really important. I mean, why would she have made a choice like that?
Well, she was trained in the theological view that there were degrees of marriage. Mormons have degrees of glory, and there are degrees of marriage, and plural marriage was the highest. And a monogamous marriage within Mormon culture was a second-class kind of marriage, and marrying an outsider was the worst form of marriage. And I imagine that this fellow who followed her from Pennsylvania, hoping to marry her, was a non-Mormon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that would have been that would have been like a death in the family for her to marry outside the Mormon faith. And so the indoctrination that she had received, the worldview that she had received since childhood, was that plural marriage was the highest form of matrimony. And also, there were degrees within plural marriage, that marrying just anybody was a high form of marriage. But then marrying somebody in the leadership elite of the LDS Church, that was the ultimate. And when she was given this opportunity to marry the brother of the counselor in the first presidency, who himself was a high-ranking member of the church hierarchy at the local level, almost the highest-ranking member at the local level as president of the Salt Lake Stake, this would have triggered all of those elements of her training that she'd received since childhood.
Here's another moment from the film. This is the actor Sandra Shotwell reading Martha Hughes Cannon.
Plural wives look upon marriage as a sacred duty and not as a means of self-seeking vanity. I've heard sentimentalists say that polygamy destroys poetry and takes all the sentiment out of life. Nonsense. A man loves all his wives. He's not in love with just one of them.
So she seems convincing, right, there. And and she says, in you quote her, she says she's not just satisfied, but in fact proud of the fact that she's done this.
Mm-hmm. This is early on,
and this is early on. So I guess that's the question. At what point does her opinion about all of this start to get squishy?
I think when she's in exile and she really starts to feel the hardship of the separation and the difficulty, I think that's where she really starts to look at this form of marriage. The other thing is her public side versus her private side. I don't think she would publicly ever denounce polygamy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think she really was a public supporter of it. But I think privately she definitely would talk about the shift and the difficulty. And I think the biggest problem was she was this romantic. She did fall in love with Angus. I mean, she fell in love with the spiritual side of the man, and she wanted him to be her soulmate.
Yeah.
Even if she shared, it was an odd concept, she could share him with other women, but she wanted that deep connection with him. And I think it was that lack of that deep connection and his complete inability to really understand that side of her that eventually just soured her on this notion of plural marriage.
Mm. I think, just to qualify what Nancy said, I do not think she was ever soured on the idea of plural marriage. She remained to the end of her life, as best I can tell, convinced that that was a right decision for her and it was good. What soured her was
Angus.
It was Angus, yeah.
No, it was the difficulty of living in that system.
Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Well,
because you're not there with them all of the time.
Right. And, like Nancy was talking about his soulmate. It's hard to be a soulmate with someone you see only a couple of times a year. And, of course, in her later life, rarely saw. And and it comes out again in these early letters. He married his fifth wife just before she left for exile. And her letters are full of little digs. Well, I'm sure you're talking to your young Maria now. Maria being also Maddie's middle name.
Yeah, 6 months younger than she was,
yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
That's interesting, too. Was she pregnant at this time? No. Mm-hmm. This is the thing, though. It seems like all of these crucial things that happen in her life happen right when she gets pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Well, pregnancy really is the...
That's the thing that's the evidence.
It's the evidence.
That you are in this relationship.
Exactly. The children become the evidence. And so it should be this joyous occasion becomes this, here we go again. So it seems like the pregnancies, the giving birth are sort of precipitous moments for her leaving.
Yeah.
Well, there's signs of her public life clashing against her private life, and that happens over and over in her life. She's able to reconcile them every time until the birth of her last daughter.
So here's a question that I wonder about. Did she, Michael Quinn, do you figure, and any woman of the time, have much of a choice to get pregnant? Like, was there birth control? Were there abortions? Was that even conceivable? Did she want to be pregnant? Were these accidents? Do we have any clue about that? Do you know anything about that?
Well, the medical literature of the time had different options that if somebody read a medical dictionary, and there were dictionaries published from the late 1700s onward about conception. And some of them, as early as the 1830s, were being heralded as the way of choosing when to have a baby and what sex the baby could be. Yeah. But we would regard now that medical knowledge that was published in the 1830s and 40s as folklore.
Yeah.
For example, in the 1830s, the attitude was that the more a man had sexual intercourse, the less likely he was to have children. And so in one sense, polygamy itself was a form of birth control by the medical knowledge of that time.
Wow.
And so, you know, the abortion certainly existed. Abortion is ancient in terms of its practice. But for a Mormon woman of faith, this was not an option. But in terms of the recognition of when a woman is fertile and the issues of the fertility periods, those were very poorly understood by yeah. physicians at the time. But the reality of polygamy was that polygamy was a form of birth control, not because a man was having sex a lot, but because the women were having access to that man infrequently.
Yeah.
And the likelihood of that visit occurring when the woman was fertile and ovulating was a very unlikely. And so it was a form of birth control on the part of the woman because of the infrequent access that the husband had to her sexually.
So she loved her children, all of them, clearly. But do you have any sense whether she, when she in fact became pregnant, wanted to become pregnant? Does that make sense?
My guess is that she did want to become pregnant. She embraced all aspects of being a woman. She would have considered having children a normal progression. So
she did. I think, though, it was very physically tough on her. And she questioned, I just remember reading one letter where she actually questioned her ability to be not be a mother, but to have children. And so I think she saw it as a role that she wanted to fulfill, but it was one that was just physically tough on her.
At one point when she was in exile, she diagnosed herself as being pregnant with twins.
Right.
She wrote Angus, and she was excited. We'll be coming back to the States at this point, and if you remember correctly, you'll know when this happened, and so on. Of course, she was not pregnant, but she was excited.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Joining us now is Lisa in American Fork. It's actually Lisa Olson Tate. She's actually in the film.
She is.
Lisa, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
You guys are actually kind of on the subject that I was thinking about here because as I've seen the film, which, Nancy, great job. It's really nice.
Thanks.
I've kind of wondered about this pattern in her life of this push and pull, where she'll push herself forward but then pull back, as you say, often in the form of getting pregnant. So she goes to medical school, but then she comes home and she marries into polygamy. She establishes her practice, but then she gets pregnant. She gets into the legislature, gets pregnant again. And, you know, we don't ever you're doing a good job of talking about how we can't really untangle all the different issues and how intentional that is. But, you know, to bring it up to date, that's something that I have seen in the lives of women that I know, where they get to the point where they can go to school or they can go back to work or they can do something that they've put on hold, and they start to move forward, but then they pull back again, often by getting pregnant. And I think it speaks really profoundly to the ambivalence that women often feel, and I think Maddie herself experienced, about their own desires, ambitions, talents, and then the external messages about what's appropriate, what's right, and you know, just the deep divide that there often is in women's lives about what am I supposed to do and what do I want to do and how do I put those things together.
Mm. Yeah, I've often wondered about that too with her. Is she self-sabotaging in some way? And I can't know.
Yep.
I mean, that's a thing. But it is. It's so common. That was the first thing that came to my mind. was, you know, it is that pull that is, it's interesting that, you know, her story happened so long ago, and yet we're still struggling with those same issues.
Well, that's what makes it a good story. She's incredibly complex as a character. Lisa, thanks.
You bet. Thanks.
801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Tricia is with us in Sandy. Tricia, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing, Doug?
Fine, thanks.
It is so interesting for me to listen to this because, actually, I'm former Utah State Representative Tricia Beck.
Oh.
And my ancestor, my great-grandfather, was Angus M. Cannon.
Okay.
And right after I'd become a legislator, which would have been following the 1996 election, so 100 years later, my children were assigned to do something in a church class, a primary class, they were 4 and 5, on one of their ancestors. Well, even though I'm not a direct descendant of Martha Hughes Cannon, I've always been fascinated by her history. So I quickly wrote up a little skit for them. And then my mother, who was one of the members of the committee for the Cannon reunion, asked the boys if they would perform the skit. And sitting in the audience that day were some of Martha Hughes Cannon's ancestors. And they just hooted. They just absolutely loved it. I have always loved reading her history. And even though I'm not a direct descendant of her, I am so excited to claim that I have some relationship, even though it may be with Angus M. Cannon. And we had some things in common. I am a Democrat. I used to joke with my husband, why don't you run as the Republican? And then I worked a lot on health care, which obviously she worked a lot on, and she worked a lot on disability issues with the deaf and blind school.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. Representative, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Glad you called. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Well, we need to take a break. Let me just mention Nancy Green is with us, producer of the new documentary Martha Hughes Cannon. Constance Lieber is with us, co-editor of the book Letters from Exile, The Correspondence of Martha Hughes Cannon and Angus M. Cannon. And D. Michael Quinn, an independent historian, is joining us as well. Sunday night at 8 o'clock, you can see the film on KUED Channel 7. For other broadcast dates, go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the life of a remarkable Utah woman, Martha Hughes Cannon. There's a new documentary produced by the PBS station KUED Channel 7 here in Salt Lake City that airs on Sunday about her life. It's called Martha Hughes Cannon. Nancy Green, the producer, is joining us here along with Constance Lieber and D. Michael Quinn. So in 1890, there comes D. Michael Quinn, what you call this, or somebody does in the film anyway, the seismic shift in the story, what has come to be called the Manifesto, where the LDS Church starts to rethink or change its position on polygamy. D. Michael Quinn, talk a little bit about that, because you say in the film the stakes here are really high. I mean, the church is essentially facing destruction.
Yeah, the man who issued the manifesto, Wilford Woodruff, as president of the church, had publicly preached that it would be impossible to give up the practice of plural marriage, and if the church did, that would be an evidence that the church had abandoned God. And so that had been his public stance through officially published sermons 20 years before. And then the only reason he gave the manifesto was that he saw the church facing absolute destruction. The other complication, not only as a reversal of what had been a doctrine that this was a practice that could not be abandoned, but it also was there was an evolution in understanding what the manifesto meant.
Yeah.
And initially, he himself, even privately, explained to the apostles that he met with, who are the second echelon of leadership in the LDS Church, that it was only intended to apply to America, to the United States of America, and its laws. It didn't apply to Mexico, didn't apply to Canada. and that it did not apply to the relationships of men who had already entered into plural marriage. Mm. And so for the first year, that is how everyone understood it. But then it became clear, and it was communicated by leaders of the nation who were friendly to the Mormons, who wanted to see the confiscated properties of the church returned, who wanted to see Utah become a state. They communicated to the leadership, that Wilford Woodruff and others, that those things wouldn't happen unless the church publicly abandoned even the living of plural marriage and the fathering and mothering of new children. And so in 1891, the president of the church, his counselors, and the president of the Quorum of the Twelve all went on record, which was published in the Deseret News, the church's newspaper, as saying that the manifesto applied worldwide, and it applied to unlawful cohabitation. In other words, that men and women who had previously entered into plural marriage prior to the manifesto were, according to the law of the church announced in October 1891, were required to cease sexual cohabitation. And that was a huge, devastating message to these husbands and wives who thought they were not affected by the manifesto, yeah, because they had entered into it prior to its issuance. And that affected Angus M. Cannon and Mattie Hughes Cannon, because now they faced the question, what do we do in our private lives now that this is the official position of the church?
Where does that leave Martha Hughes Cannon? Do we know? How does she react to that news? How does she react to that?
So I haven't come across any writings of her reaction.
Is it hard to
know? It's really hard to know. I mean, it seems like they didn't really alter their relationship very much, Angus and Mattie. But then again, she never really lived with him. I mean, she was much more independent than a lot of other women.
But she still lived as a polygamist wife. And I guess that's typical, right? I mean, a lot of people did, even after the manifesto.
Yes, but it was a happenstance thing.
Yeah.
I've read diaries of men and women who, after that testimony was published in the Deseret News, said, this ends our marriage. And a number of men and women decided that their marriage was over, and that if they didn't formally end it through asking for a church divorce, it was ended in practical terms. Mm. Others grappled with this and temporarily ended cohabitation, and Apostle Heber G. Grant was one of them, who temporarily, feeling that it was the public stance of the church that he should support, he temporarily stopped cohabiting with his plural wives. And then when he found so many plural wives who were having children, including children of president of the church, apostles, that, when I say president of the church, it was Lorenzo Snow, whose plural wife bore him a child in 1896, 5 years before he became president of the church. But the fact that this became known, that there were many in the church's elite who were still cohabiting with their wives, caused some who were aware of this to say, oh, well, I guess it isn't required. And so then they retreated from a position that they had taken, and that applied to Heber J. Grant as well. And I don't know whether it applied to Angus Cannon and Mattie Hughes Cannon, if they had temporarily discontinued sexual relations and then resumed them after a period of time. Hmm. But it was a very contested period, and you had some people who interpreted the manifesto exactly as it had been published, that it applied to sexual cohabitation.
She becomes Martha Hughes Cannon. We don't have time. We're running out of time. One of the best stories in the film, so I recommend you to see, is the fact that she runs against Angus M. Cannon for the state legislature. There are a number of people on the list, but certainly her husband was one of them. The Democrats asked her. The Republicans asked him to run. So she becomes the state senator, first in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then she gets pregnant again. And that was the end of it, I guess, Nancy Green. This was the huge scandal.
It was a national scandal. It was in newspapers all across the country. And as Constance and I've talked about, it really is this sense where it's the final straw, where her private and public lives just completely clash. Mm. You know, the decisions she makes trying to be a mother can't coincide. It can't exist with her decision also wanting to be in the public spotlight as a senator, because she's breaking the laws of the land by, you know, cohabiting with her husband. It's proof she's still in a polygamous marriage, and she basically serves out her term, but that's it. That's really pretty much the end of the public life of Martha Hughes Cannon. Mm.
Let me ask you this finally. There's a Kate Holbrook in your film, a specialist in women's history at the Church History Department for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and she says in the film that Maddie's life story feels as relevant today as it did when she was living it. Do you think that's Do you feel like that in some way?
I do.
It's still
a really
relevant story.
I think that's the amazing aspect of it to me. I think the clash of romanticism and ideals and practical reality, I think the difficulty of, for anyone, how do you balance family life, your personal life, and your public life? How do you pursue making some good in the world, and yet focusing on your internal self? I think all of these struggles are struggles that we can relate to today as men and women, but I think especially women are still dealing with that. And so I think she's just as relevant today as she was, you know, 100 years ago.
Nancy Green, producer of the new documentary film Martha Hughes Cannon. Constance Lieber, co-editor of the book Letters from Exile, the correspondence of Martha Hughes Cannon and Angus M. Cannon. And D. Michael Quinn, independent historian. His work focuses on the LDS Church. Thank you all very much for being
with
us.
Thank you.
Sunday night at 8 o'clock, KUED Channel 7 is premiering the film. For details and other broadcast dates, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Eileen Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.